Organizers now for the final time, so let's give them a round of applause. This was great and very well organized. And it being the last talk, I promise to end on time, and I will thank Eva, although she's made my life difficult in some ways, for giving me a couple of extra minutes so that I promise I will get there. Now, I have given a talk on the subject once before, I tried to cover all of the results that we have, and I found that in the end, it didn't work very well. And so I'm going to try instead to be more pedagogical and give you our main result. There are many more results. I should say at the initial, right at the start, this is work with Rich Brower, Chung-Yi Tan, and Joe Polchinski. And the main reason that it's difficult to cover all the results here is that even the motivation for this subject is so poorly known in the community, that even includes the QCD community, that it's worth just sort of laying out the problem, laying out what we know about it, and to do so carefully, since otherwise you may see lots of results and wonder why I spent any time deriving them. But I will say at the start that although I probably won't get to that point, this would be a second talk probably, this is, I believe, the first time that string theory has been able to be applied to and possibly to resolve a previously unsolved and perhaps insoluble problem within QCD, which is issues having to do with the analyticity of amplitudes, covering both the confining regime and the regime where you expect perturbation theory to be valid, namely the ultraviolet conformal regime. And the string theory can handle that because, of course, it just treats both with differential equations. It doesn't have a problem the way QCD does, where you to study the confining dynamics, you'd want lattice gauge theory. To study the perturbative dynamics, you do Feynman diagrams with no idea how to connect them. String theory does that for you. Now, this again, as always, this is not a study of QCD. This is a study in the end of ultraviolet conformal infrared confining theories with large TUF coupling. So they're not the same as QCD. But the hope, as always, is that if you can learn something which is sufficiently general, that for example, such as an analytic structure of an amplitude, that might be preserved without a phase transition to smaller TUF coupling. But that's, of course, a hypothesis, a guess. We don't, of course, have a proof of such a thing. But nonetheless, I want to start by laying out the problem, the motivation for this whole thing. Why would one ever do what these fellows BF, K, and L did? So BF, K, and L, who are they? Belitsky, Fadin, Krayev, and Lipatov. This work was done in the mid-70s. And if you've ever looked at a description of what they did, you probably closed the book almost as fast as you opened it. It's some crazy resummation scheme for calculating some amplitude you didn't know was interesting. And so I have to first lay out what was the question. And I'm not going to do this chronologically because, in fact, from the chronological point of view, it's very confusing. But I would rather do it from a pedagogical point of view. The question is motivated first by some physics issues, although a lot of it is at some level a formal but important formal question, which we've actually dealt with in string theory for many years. But let's start with physics. For example, supposing you want to scatter a proton off a proton, you want to do it at high energy, and you want to know what's the most important thing that happens at high energy. What's the dominant process? What dominates the high energy scattering? What dominates sigma total for, let's say, PP bar scattering or PP scattering, either one? And you look at the data, total cross-section versus energy, and you discover the cross-section is doing this for PP, and you discover the cross-section looks like this for PP bar. And let me give you some units on this. This is somewhere around 20 GeV. This is up at Fermilab energies. This is a log plot, really. Up here, unmeasured as yet, is LHC. And the most important thing you see is the protons are growing. Or at least the total cross-section is growing, and one way to say that is that the protons are becoming bigger. And the question is, what's driving this? You notice also that the rates are the same for proton-proton as for proton-antiproton, so whatever's driving it is in some way universal. It doesn't care about the quantum numbers involved. It's really something fundamental to hadronic physics itself. And so that's part of why it's interesting. And also part of why, well, given that it's universal, you might have some hope of saying something universal about it. You can check this for other scattering processes. You see similar behavior. Another thing that you could look at, which is also interesting, is you could look at the differential cross-section with respect to T. And T, as you may remember, in a scattering process, 2 goes to 2 is negative. So I'll plot minus T here. And what you see is a very sharp peak. This is also universal. And the words that go with this growth here and this rapid fall-off, exponential fall-off here, are one of the places that Reggie's name appears. And I'll come back to that in a second. But the important thing is here, there's some exponential fall-off with T. There's another place that you could, this is for, well, so T is the Mandelstam variable for 2 goes to 2 scattering, or for, basically here, elastic scattering. So we have particles 1 and 2 going to particles 3 and 4 by some interaction I'm not saying anything about per se. And the Mandelstam variables are S, the center mass energy squared, and I think I've defined it with a minus sign in this talk, and T, which is P3 minus P1 squared. That's the momentum transferred squared.
The sigma total is that PPR goes into X.
This is literally, so this is really total, so this would be the imaginary part of elastic scatter.
So for the amplitude, for the limiting high energy case of that, are you
We don't know if we are or not. Okay. So part of the problem is that the interpretation of this graph is controversial. Interpretation of this is a little less
controversial.
We don't know if, well, I'm going to describe what Reggie physics really is in a minute. That is to say, from the point of view of what it means in terms of amplitudes. We don't actually know that this represents that, but I will say something specific about that in a minute. So again, what I'm telling you right now, maybe I shouldn't have put these words here yet. What I'm really telling you now is there are things to explain in data. There's another, and so this is, you know, this kind of thing is important because you'd like to know what the total cross-section is going to be at LHC and what kind of physics it's going to, where it's going to come from. Perhaps even more worrying is things that you would learn from deep and elastic scattering. So, this is electron scattering off of protons, where the proton goes to anything. And that's the imaginary part of basically stripping off the electron, which is not doing very much here except providing you with an off-shell photon, a momentum q mu, is that you can think of forward scattering of a photon off a proton and cut this. And of course, that's usually defined in terms of as an amplitude or a structure function in terms of q squared. And the Bjorkane X variable, which everybody knows about, you're usually told that's the fraction of the proton's momentum that is carried by the parton that actually strikes, that's actually struck by the photon. But what you may not have realized is that X, if you write it out in terms of the energy in the center of mass of the photon-proton plane of the frame, is actually inversely proportional to the center mass energy. So very curious surprise if you've never thought about this. Small x is large energy. You might have thought that would be very soft stuff. But because the photon is space-like, your intuition's a little off for this. So if you want to know what's going on in the proton at small x, you're actually asking a high-energy question. And indeed, this talk is really about what happens at high energy, right? So small x is a similar issue, and small x is important because at small x in the proton you have lots and lots of gluons, and in fact the LHC is really a gluon-gluon collider. There are a few quarks thrown in for good measure. It's basically a gluon-gluon collider, and you've got lots and lots and lots of gluons at small x. There can be multiple scattering when protons hit other protons. A lot of processes can go on involving those extremely small x gluons, and we know very little about them. So trying to understand something about them would be good. And now, I should say perhaps in advance that this the BFKL didn't solve this problem. But this is why people study this question, because this is an important issue. You'd like to be able to understand it well. And the Hera experiment was designed to try to tell us at least something about this problem, to try to understand parton distribution functions at small x. But I think it's fair to say, while many people thought there was a possibility they would see physics of this type, that too is completely controversial. And so unfortunately, it looks very likely that even at LHC, we're not going to understand enough about these parton distribution functions to do the best possible physics, which is a shame. But I'll leave that aside and stick with the theoretical issue for now. You'd like to know what is the gluon parton distribution function as a function of x and q squared. And how do you calculate that? Well, the answer either to this question or to any of these questions is just not, in general, a perturbative question. It's non-perturbative physics. And even if you come up with a situation where you contrive things, and we will, so that you're studying a problem which is a little bit, which is outside of being dominated by confinement, which all of these things really are dominated by confining physics, if you get to some place where confinement is less important, as to some degree it is here, you're still never calculating one Feynman diagram. You're always calculating an infinite number and trying to resum processes. And that's always what makes things difficult. And what BFKL were doing was trying to find a resummation procedure such that they could solve at least some of these problems or address some of these problems in some way. So they gave some answer, but what's the question? I mean, one way to phrase the issue here, which is one that very useful and string theorists have actually been encouraged to do so by some of the older generation, like Lenny Susskind, is to think about it from the following point of view. If you're scattering two protons off each other, ask the question, what does the second proton look like from the first proton's point of view? How does the second proton change? How does particle number two change from the point of view of particle number one as you boost it? So, in other words, what is d by ds, s being this center mass energy? If I hold particle one fixed, I increase the energy of particle number two. What is d by ds? Or even better, what is d by d log s of particle two from the point of view of particle one? This is an interesting question, and it's an interesting way to phrase the question because it looks rather similar to the sort of question you ask in the renormalization group, where you say, okay, how does something change with respect to scale? And that's not accidental. There are relationships here, which I think it's fair to say nobody fully understands. It's still confusion, although people are working on this and have been for about the last 10 years in QCD trying to understand exactly what this is about. But it certainly has to do with the Minkowski form of the conformal group, and it would be nice to get this straight. And understand exactly how the representation theory works and what the fact that the boosts and the dilatations both appear in the conformal group, what relations are implied by that fact alone, and so forth. But this is something I won't go into further for this talk. What I want to do, though, is look at situations where we actually do know the answer to this question. And the first one is string theory itself. Ordinary flat space string theory. We know to ask and answer this question. And you can figure out, you can find out how to do this in the first chapter, in fact, I think the first section maybe even of the chapter of Green, Schwartz, and Witten, where they consider the first problem ever studied in string theory, basically, or let's say the closed string version of it. And what you're interested in is the limit where S, center mass energy squared, is much larger than T, or one, again, it's scattering, so I'll put minus T here. T is negative in this kinematic regime. And it's also much bigger than 1 over alpha prime. And since the angle of scattering for small angles is of order the square root of t over s, this is small, very small angles. And you consider the question, what happens as s gets large for t fixed? And now let me remind you that, as they point out, the amplitude here can be written as a sum in the t-channel of many individual particles being exchanged between these two stringy states, sum over poles in the t-channel. Of course, you could write it as sum over poles in the s-channel also, but let's write it as sum over poles in the t-channel. And each one of these poles has s to a power of a spin of the particle that's being exchanged divided by the t-channel propagator. And of course, there's some number here, which depends on which particle you're scattering. So for each particle that we exchange here, the answer to this question is j. On the other hand, when you sum them up, that's not the answer you get. Because it's an infinite sum, you get a very interesting behavior where s is raised to a power, which is a function of t, continuously varying function of t, and there's alpha primes floating around, which I won't put in. Things have to get this dimensionally correct. Of course, you have to throw additional things in. I won't worry about that at the moment. But the interesting thing is that whereas particle by particle, of course, you always get an integer here, the sum does not behave that way. You get the answer is the answer to what how does this behave is d by d log s is alpha of t, which is some sort of effective spin that depends on t. It's sort of like an anomalous spin, sort of like an anomalous dimension. And if you know that alpha of t, then you know the answer to these questions, at least in the regime where the classical string theory free level dominates the amplitude. The amplitude is going to grow like s to the alpha of 0. And this falloff here is just the falloff for fixed s as you vary t. It's just the variation of alpha of t with t. Okay. Now, of course, actually, you don't just get one function like this. You get a sum of many terms. But there's one that dominates. And let's review how that happens. So I'll draw the famous picture that we've all seen a million times. So there is, of course, going to be a pole in this formula at t equals 0 corresponding to the graviton. So at alpha t equals 2, something interesting should happen for t equals 0. And indeed, what are these alpha of t's? These are the Regi trajectories. They are linear in string theory, although in general, to have nice amplitudes of this type that have ST channel duality, you don't necessarily need that. But in string theory, alpha of t for each one of these lines is some alpha naught plus alpha prime t. And in principle, there could be other terms, but they're absent. Okay. And whenever alpha of t is equal to an integer, there is actually a physical pole corresponding to the existence of a particle. And there's all of these different trajectories, but this one is the leading trajectory. Now, why is it leading? It's leading for the following reason. The amplitude for the cross-section involves a sum over terms like this. It's going to be the imaginary part of a forward scattering amplitude, so it'll be t equals 0. Therefore, whatever has s to the highest possible power wins. And the thing that has s to the highest possible power is the trajectory that has the highest value of alpha naught. So this trajectory is the leading one. And all of the others are called daughter trajectories. And we won't worry much about them today. Okay. So as t goes to 0, the leading trajectory dominates. the total cross section, which goes like s to the power alpha naught minus 1 for the leading trajectory. And for string theory, where alpha naught for the leading trajectory is 2, that means the cross section grows like s, and you know unitarity is going to be violated in a big hurry. And so at some point you have to say, well, okay, this can't possibly be the right answer. It must be that higher loop amplitudes or some other non-perturbative physics comes in. And indeed, if you look at Gross and Mende, there will be corrections to this at high energy. And at some point, you'll start making black holes, and many things will change. So this is certainly not the final answer. But there is a regime, the coupling is sufficiently small, where this is the dominant behavior. And let us proceed with the assumption that we are in that regime for now. Now, what I want to do is I want to take this formula, and I just want to write it in a slightly bizarre way. Actually, I want to take not that formula, but this one for the amplitude. And I want to write it in a slightly bizarre way, but one which will prove useful. So I guess I didn't want to erase the figure. I want to think about the amplitude as being a process that's not going this way, but I want to think about it in this channel. So it's some sort of transition between a state that starts with particle 2 and antiparticle 4 bar, goes to particles 1 and 3 bar, and what appears in the middle is e to the log s alpha of t. Now, what is t? T is Laplacian applied to the right. It picks up the momentum of particles 2 and 4 bar. And although I define t, which I've erased apparently, I define t as being p3 minus p1. I could just as easily have defined it as p4 minus p2 squared. So this is just a way of rewriting this formula. Now, why do this? Well, when you're doing very high energy scattering, you can usefully divide things up in the following way. The two particles are coming in. You can work in the frame where they're coming back to back. So that defines a beam axis. So time and your beam axis pick up two directions. And everything else is transverse to the beam. So what happens in this scattering, if it's at small angle, is that P2 and P4 share almost the same dynamics along the beam. You've barely changed the momentum in those directions. You've only changed the momentum in the transverse dimensions. So T is, in fact, simpler than that. The box here can be replaced with an ordinary derivative in the spatial directions perpendicular to the beam. So that's del perp squared. And then we actually need to expand this out. There'll be an s to the alpha naught, 1, 3 bar, e to the log s alpha prime del perp squared. Did I lose a sign? Yeah, I lost a sign. That should be plus. Okay. This is interesting because this operator is a diffusion operator. Right? This is what you would normally expect with a time, right? You would expect e to the minus t, t is a bad term, e to the minus tau del perp squared would be a natural diffusion operator, some sort of heat kernel. So what we've got is diffusion with a time, which is alpha prime log s. And so we know what this would be if we went from momentum space back to position space. So let's do that. So this is the Fourier transform of some sort of operator, which is roughly speaking, and I'm being a little schematic here. It's a diffusion kernel written now in position space. Now, what is a diffusion kernel? What is it doing here? Well, it's telling us exactly what we already know, which is that strings grow as you boost them. Strings become larger, and how do they become larger? They become larger in the following way. Their size grows as the square root of the log of the energy. And we're just seeing that from, I mean, it just literally follows from the fact that what was the logic? Alpha of t appears in the amplitude. It's linear in t. Therefore, we get something which goes like e to the del squared here. And therefore, we have diffusion and growth. And what does that correspond to physically? And what does it correspond to physically? Well, Susskind gave us a nice way to think about this. At least that's where I learned to think about it this way, which is that, look, you look at a string and it's coming towards you. You have a certain time resolution on your camera when you take a picture of it. If it's coming towards you faster, it's time dilated, so your picture actually sees the string for a shorter amount of time. And the string is a fluctuating object. If you look at it for a long period of time, those fluctuations average out, and there's your string. But if you take a picture faster, or if the string is boosted so that it's time dilated, so you're taking a picture of it at a smaller time in its own frame, its wiggles start to become more and more obvious to you. And the faster your shutter speed, the more the wiggles are there, and the larger it gradually becomes. And it grows just by a random walk, which means it grows like the square root of some appropriate time, and that time is the, when you translate that back, is this one. Okay, so this is all familiar, although phrased in a way which is a little bit unfamiliar, perhaps, but not exactly difficult to understand. Now, what about in QCD? Why does the word regiphysics, which is, of course, what this is, come up in QCD? So the question in QCD is the same. Or at least a way to phrase the question is the same. We might do proton-proton scattering and ask, all right, what happens here in precisely the same type of regime? Instead of alpha prime, of course, I'll put here lambda QCD squared. But I'll have to add a restriction here, which I don't have to add in the flat space regime, which is that I shouldn't take S too big, and I probably don't want T large compared to the QCD scale squared. It's less than or of order. And why that's the case, I'll come back to. OK, now, of course, in this regime, if T is small compared to the QCD scale, that means there's some non-trivial kinematic invariants which are sitting right at the confinement scale, and I'm sorry, I don't know how to calculate that. You might say, well, maybe you could calculate it using lattice gauge theory, but this is a very highly Minkowskian process that you're talking about, very high energy, very small angle scattering. There's no way to calculate this using lattice gauge theory either. So this is just plain old incalculable. But you can measure it, and you can try to fit it with a formula of this type, motivated, if you were back in the 60s, by the fact that you didn't know about QCD yet, and you were trying to fit string theory to the data. And it doesn't work that badly. I mean, that's part of where this exponential falloff that I erased that was sitting on the graph in the middle here comes from. And you can certainly try to fit it to this, setting t equal to 0 and just trying to see what power appears here. And if you do that, you can get a fit. I mean, I don't know if it's the right thing to do. I don't know if this really is representative of behavior exactly like this. But if you do it, you would get alpha naught is about 1.1, and alpha prime is about 1 over 2 GeV quantity squared for QCD, which you don't get from this graph, but you get from the other one, which I erased through the exponential falloff. What else? Also, by the way, you can find evidence that alpha double prime is small, as it is in flat space string theory, which is interesting, although I won't have anything to say about that. Now, let's see, what about the alpha of t's from a different point of view? For example, what about from this point of view? Well, of course, one of the key differences between string theory and QCD is the absence of a massless spin 2 particle. That's sort of, you know, the biggest thing you'd ever think of. But let me just save myself a little trouble here and just put the axis in a new place. What we learn from the fact that alpha naught is 1.1 is that the leading trajectory should intersect this axis just above 1, if this is the right picture. And then where the same trajectory intersects 2, there should be a glue ball. Now, is it true that the spectrum of QCD has a form like this? Well, the answer is we don't know, at least for the glue balls, because the glue balls are also unstable, that they decay before you can even see them. But if you look at the vector mesons, the spin 1 mesons like the row and corresponding spin 3, spin 5, so forth of the row, you'll find that, yes, there does seem to be a linear trajectory for them. So although that's experimental, this is not, but we infer that this is a reasonable picture for QCD, even though that itself has not been tested. So let us presume that the data on vector mesons is salient and that this is really an appropriate picture for QCD. What can we say about this? Well, again, this is the leading trajectory. It has a name in QCD. It doesn't have a name. You just call it the leading trajectory. It's got the graviton on it. So the graviton's trajectory. But this trajectory has a name, which unfortunately sounds like the name of a particle, but is not. It's called the Pomeron in QCD. And again, it's given by summing up the effects of not one particle, but all of the particles on this leading trajectory, and such that they give you some function alpha of t, which, well, is this line here. To try to actually understand these numbers from QCD is pretty hard. I mean, this is fully non-perturbative. But at least in lattice gauge theory, what you could do in principle, although it's not easy, is you could in principle measure the actual masses of these things and check whether this is a linear trajectory up here positive t. Now, there's a curious thing here which I didn't emphasize when I was talking about the string theory, but it's important. We draw this picture, which shows all the particles. That tells us about the sum over poles in the t-channel, which appears here. But the actual amplitudes are never evaluated there. They're evaluated where you do the scattering. Where you do the scattering is at t less than 0. So you're actually really interested. If you want to calculate anything that will show up in an experiment, you want to know what happens if you continue these trajectories down to negative t. And in string theory, we know the answer. They remain linear. In QCD, we don't know that. We only know from data, first of all, about the vector mesons, but at best about the glue balls from lattice data, we would at best know about this region. So there's a question, what happens down here? And you can convince yourself that the answer in QCD cannot be the same as the answer in string theory. Because in string theory, you know there's another regime that you could go to, where instead of taking small angle scattering, you take fairly large angle scattering. So you take the energy large, and you look at fixed moderate angles. And then in string theory, the exclusive scattering of 2 goes to 2 falls off exponentially because of that e to the minus t behavior. Okay, so moderate angles in 2 goes to 2, strings tell you that the amplitudes fall like e to the minus t. But in QCD, you're getting closer and closer as you increase the angles, all the kinematic variables becoming large compared to the confinement scale. You're getting more and more to the point that you would believe something like perturbation theory would apply. And if you use perturbation theory, which is not entirely justified, or if you just use conformal invariance arguments, which, you know, the theory is scale invariant at the higher energy you go, you would expect, perhaps, 1 over t to a power. And if you do the experiments, that's what you find, t to a power. It's not exponentially falling off. And so this alpha of t cannot be linear forever. Right? Something's got to happen. And a lot of people have suggested that, well, it kind of levels off, becomes sort of logarithmic so that you get a power here. So maybe these things are bending over in some way. And OK, nobody knows. And nobody knows because perturbation theory sits out here at large negative t at best. And here you've got your lattice gauge theory calculations at best. And you don't have any data which connects these two things. Indeed, you can't because your kinematics of scattering only goes down to this point. And so you can't use data to tell this story. You can't do any calculations to tell this story. You don't have any theory which allows you to tell this story until now, where at least we can look at how this works in string theory in a string theory that's dual, not this flat space string theory, but a string theory which actually might be dual to a gauge theory of this type, and we might be able to calculate the structure altogether. I probably won't get there today, but I'll at least set up the beginning. Okay. Now, let me set up a problem where I would be pretty much guaranteed that I could address this question d by d log s of a particular particle as I boost it, but it should not be given by some non-perturbative question. I should be able to actually calculate it in perturbation theory, maybe not in a trivial way. But that would be, if I could cook up such a problem, then I would be in a position to hope that I really could apply QCD as I really understand it, and even though I wouldn't be able to answer this question about what's going on down here in the near the confining regime, I would at least be able to answer some question definitively. And so let's pick the following problem. Let's take QCD, or QCD-like theory. In fact, let's simplify it. Just take pure Yang-Mills theory and add to it one type, one flavor of quark that's quite heavy compared to the confinement scale. Quark of mass m, much, much larger than lambda QCD squared, but lambda QCD. I think I'll drop the QCDs from now on, just call it lambda whenever I'm talking about a confinement scale. The important thing about a quarkonium state, aside from the fact that its mass is large, is that its size is small. Its size will be 1 over, the Bohr radius for an atom is 1 over the mass of the light particle. Here the particle is the same size, so mass will appear in the denominator. And normally you would put alpha here, but this is a non-abelian gauge theory we're talking about, so there's an n. Or in other words, in terms of the Atoff coupling, lambda, little lambda, it's 1 over lambda m. So it's bigger than the inverse mass scale, but it still could be much, much smaller if we tune things right than 1 over the QCD scale, 1 over the confinement scale. And so this is an object which is small. Confinement scale is way out here. And so I should be able to calculate how this thing grows as I boost it. And until it gets to be as big as the confinement scale, that should be something I should be able to do. Fair enough? Now, why would it grow, by the way? Why do protons grow? It's actually something I left out in my discussion, but let's remember why that might be true. Why, for example, would you expect that the parton distribution function for gluons would become very large at small x? Why is that happening? It should be somehow corresponding to the fact that the proton is growing. Well, it's the following statement, that if I take a proton, let's say, with some quarks and some gluons in it, and I look at it at a shorter time scale, same kind of argument as with string theory, I should be able to extract the fact that any given parton at any given moment may have emitted a bunch of gluons. And the gluons themselves may have split to quark-antiquark pairs. So if I look at the proton at shorter and shorter time scales, I should see more and more very low momentum particles. And of course, they're going to be distributed in a region which grows very slowly, just because I'm placing them down randomly. So gradually, there's more and more and more of them, and they're also getting into a region which is bigger and bigger and bigger. Now, that's just a perturbative statement. And so that will continue to be true here. Well, it's semi-perturbative. It's perturbative in the sense that each splitting is perturbative, but then I'm going to sum over many of them. And that could give me some interesting coherent effects, which you wouldn't see one splitting at a time. So the proton is growing, but in the same way, it's affected by confinement effects in some complicated way. The quarkonium state will grow in the same way, but it won't be affected by confinement effects. I should be able to calculate how that works. So we're going to calculate how the quarkonium state grows through gluons doing something interesting and complicated. And in particular, that's not a Feynman diagram. It's going to require some sort of resummation because at large, when although the perturbation series is a series in lambda, and we can work to leading order in lambda, the problem is that there are some effects which go like lambda times the logarithm of s, and we have to resum all of those. Okay, so we're working to leading order in lambda, leading non-vanishing order in lambda, but resumming all lambda log s effects. And the question is, how do you do that in QCD Feynman diagrams? Well, that's when it's a good idea to be Russian and have learned all the latest mathematical tricks and be very, very clever. And I'm certainly not going to explain to you how they did that, because I don't understand it very well. And it would take quite a long time. In fact, it's three chapters of a book that describes the Pomeran that you can buy in your bookstore. But you can, by doing a resummation, calculate the leading answer to this question. What is d by d log s of the Quarconium state? And this is ahistorical. It's not really what they did. But it's really what you should think about doing. You really can calculate this. And I'll write down the answer in a couple of minutes. I will mention, though, some very interesting things about this answer. That is to say, when you calculate all, not really the answer, but the procedure, when you look at all of the terms that are of this form that you need to include, you discover, first of all, you're doing a calculation which essentially is in conformal field theory. Because you're working to leading order in lambda, and to see the running coupling, you would need to go to the next order. So this is essentially a calculation which would be the same in a conformal theory as in a non-conformal one. You go to the next order, you have to worry about the running coupling, and that's not trivial, but anyway, the answer we're going to deal with now would be true in a conformal field theory. The second thing you discover, which is sort of alluded to in the way I wrote this, is that although, of course, in principle, they're one over n corrections. Right? That's basically you're summing, you know, you should be summing not just over, not combining things just in alpha n, but also there should be one over n corrections to this. There aren't any. The one over n corrections don't have this enhancement of log s to the right number of powers. So if you do this resummation, it's a planar calculation. And the third thing is that the only thing which dominates are the gluons. Doesn't make any difference if there are fermions or scalars there at all. So the answer is the same for n equals 4 Yang-Mills as for QCD as for pure Yang-Mills theory. Completely universal. Conformal, planar, and gluons only. All right, now that is interesting because that means that we can, in fact, we do have something that we can compare with some interesting theory. We could calculate, we could ask the same question, n equals 4 Yang-Mills. We could take n equals 4 Yang-Mills, add a quark with some mass. We don't have to worry about the QCD scale, but it doesn't matter. We're working in the region where that wasn't supposed to be important anyway. And we could construct a Quarconium state. Essentially, the reason we can do this is that nc is large, so adding a quark is a 1 over nc correction. It doesn't change the dynamics of the theory. But you can still put in a Quarconium state and ask, how does it grow? And you can do that calculation in string theory and compare it with what you calculate in gauge theory, even though that calculation originally was just done in pure Yang-Mills or in QCD. OK, so how do you do this schematically? Well, what's the leading effect? And let's do this calculation in the following way. Let's imagine doing deep and elastic scattering off of this Quarconium state. So that's a very simple process. Remember, that's the imaginary part of forward scattering. Photon comes in, Quarconium state comes in, and they go out in the same directions that they came in. And what dominates this in this regime is the following. The photon itself can split into a quark-antiquark pair. And then that pair can exchange a pair of gluons. And that's an effect which turns out to be part of it's the first step in calculating this effect. Now, why is that true? It turns out it's a theorem, which I won't go through by any means, that what will dominate the largest eigenvalue of this question, largest eigenvalue dominating large S, is going to be one which is colorless and flavorless. And so what you want is the simplest thing that you can write down that's exchanged between these two objects that carries no color and no flavor, and that's two gluons. But now what you need to do.
What precisely do you mean by conic equivalent?
Sorry,
second? You write down some mathematical equation, d by d log s of particle 2, and you're talking about eigenvalues.
Yeah, so particle 2 really is an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. And I really can ask, what is d by d log s of that? And ask, is it an eigenstate? Or more precisely, I can write it as a sum of eigenstates of this operator. So think about this operator, ask what are its eigenstates. The overlap of this particle with that eigenstate will give the dominant contribution. Okay, so this is the leading diagram you write down, but if you try to calculate all the places that you can get lambda log s terms, you discover you need to start doing things like adding another gluon here, and indeed you need to construct entire ladders of gluons. I'm simplifying, unfortunately. And then you add ladders to those ladders. Okay, ladders of ladders of ladders of ladders of ladders, and it's more complicated than that. But in the end, what you're really doing is you're calculating some sort of kernel. Which I'll call K. And that kernel does the following. It takes two incoming gluons with momentum, which is entirely transverse to the beam. K perm prime coming in, K perm prime coming out. It's a forward scattering, so whatever momentum comes in has to come back out again. And then there's your kernel K. And what comes out are two gluons with momentum K perp and minus K perp. Well, K perp coming in and K perp coming out. Okay, so K perp prime, K perp prime up top, K perp at the bottom. Okay, and somehow this is the thing you need to calculate in order to figure out how do photons and quarkonium states scatter in order to figure out what was the quarkonium state doing as you boosted it. And so what's the form of the answer going to be? The form of the answer is going to be something like this. You're going to have an amplitude, which is going to involve an integral over dk perp prime over k perp prime, that's sort of conventional, times something which tells you about the photon. So there'll be some function which involves the photon. In fact, you might even think it's the square of some function that involves the photon, because you have an incoming photon and outgoing photon, and you would be right. And then that whole thing is going to be multiplied by this structure down at the bottom here, which is a combination of the quarkonium state and the kernel. So indeed, what you have is some sort of convolution, dk perp over k perp. The kernel, which depends on k perp and k perp prime, and then some function which tells you about the quarkonium state, which depends on k perp only. And sorry, there's a k perp prime here. Okay, so you got a convolution of some type. You have something involving the photon, which gets convoluted with the quarkonium state boosted to the appropriate s. So k also depends on s, although I didn't write that in there. Okay. And now the question is just what is k, because this is indeed the correct form. And, well, this is, again, where it's nice to be someone like Lopatov. You do a calculation, it's very long and difficult. And at the end, the answer is very beautiful. And it has a wonderful mathematical physics structure. It comes out of an integrable model, as people have discovered in the last decade. And it's really quite a remarkable thing. It's related to spin chains in some way that's not completely clear to me. So the kernel, which depends on S, the center mass of the scattering, and it depends on an incoming and an outgoing pair of gluons, is equal to an integral, which is not normally written this way, but I will write it this way because it relates more, I think, to it's just a little more physical. It's an integral over a variable I'll call J, which is often called omega, but it's basically just a spin, S to the J minus 1. Now, this is some sort of Mellin transform of something which I don't know how to write in a more convenient fashion than this. Very strange-looking formula at first glance. E to the I nu log k perp squared over k perp prime squared. Integral from minus infinity to infinity. And now there's something that looks like this. There's some function, j hat of nu, and you just get a simple pole at each value of nu. Okay, but this is therefore not going to have a pole at j because you're integrating over nu. It's going to be some sort of cut. And what is j hat? This is where everyone who does integrable models gets excited. It looks like this. The Euler constant appears, and then you get the real part of a psi function with a complex argument. Okay, not very illuminating, but very impressive. What do you do with this? Well, I mean, this is exact. It's exact in the sense that, I mean, there'll be order lambda corrections to it, but at order lambda, with all resummations, this is an exact answer. It's very impressive. But on the other hand, you haven't even measured this effect yet, so this is overkill. If you want to do a calculation like this, what you want to look at is at the fact that this function has an endpoint, J naught, which we'll calculate in a minute. Actually, I'll calculate it now. It's 1 plus 4 log 2 over pi lambda. And then it has a cut which descends below that. And so what you can do is you can approximate this integral by going to the value of J naught, where the cut ends, and looking, just doing the integral near the end of the cut. That's going to dominate the integral. Because you want to have the highest possible J in order to get the highest possible S. So you're going to be dominated by the highest value of J, which is this one, plus values which are close by. So you make a quadratic approximation. You say, well, all right, this is approximately equal to J naught minus J of 0 minus something which goes like nu squared. You can easily check this is even in nu. And then there'll be corrections that go like nu to the fourth, so forth. But we'll ignore those. And we'll plug in this. And what do we get? Well, now, if you plug this in, you get an integral which becomes a couple of poles. You can just do it. And you find the following answer. S to the J naught minus 1, where J naught is this, I changed notation on here, but it's the same thing. 1 plus 4 log 2 over lambda over pi. Square root of pi log S. That's already interesting. This does not appear in Reggie physics that we've been seeing. In string theory, you get S to a power. You do not get an additional square root of log S. That is, in fact, from the fact that if you'd done the same thing in string theory, you wouldn't have gotten a cut. You would have gotten just a pole. It would have been called the Reggie pole. Here we have a cut. And that shows up here. And then we get another factor, which is of the following form. E to the minus log k perp squared over k perp prime squared divided by 4d log s. Which is diffusion. But not diffusion in space-time. It's diffusion in momentum space, in the transverse momentum space. That's curious. D, by the way, which appears here, is of order lambda. It's some uninteresting number times something of order lambda. So both J naught is 1 plus order lambda. D is order lambda. A4 would be order lambda. Haven't used, this is just relating the BFKL result. This is the BFKL result written in the quadratic approximation, and this is well known in the QCD literature.
Right, so this diffusion in K might
relate it to
mm-hmm.
Right. So you don't get this in flat space string theory, but you're going to get it in curved space string theory. Okay. So that's going to be the point, indeed. So the issue, what happens if you do this calculation in ADS CFT, using the fact that, you know, this calculation was done in a conformal field theory at the planar level, does only involve the gluons, and therefore you think you should be able to do it there. And the answer is going to be, of course, the same structure. And
I thought you explained earlier that you get this logarithmic growth in
flat space, you get logarithmic growth in the transverse spatial dimensions.
And also a function of S,
right? Okay, so the statement was, in string theory, in flat space, you always get growth in the transverse spatial dimensions. In QCD, if you're working in the regime where confinement is important, which is the one I started with when I was over here talking about QCD, you get similar growth in space. Now we're taking a different problem. We're taking the problem of a quarkonium state, which is small compared to the confinement scale. We have a perturbative computation via resummation that we can do. And we get an answer, but it's not the answer where we get growth in position space. We get growth in momentum space. It's different. Okay. The diffusion is occurring in momentum space. And if you Fourier transform this back to position space, it's not the same. They're not equivalent. In particular, you know, the log s appears down here instead of, if you Fourier transform it, would appear in the numerator instead of the denominator. So it's different. Okay, so we want to understand why we get this, and not surprisingly, it's going to turn out that log of k perp is related to the fifth dimension in some way. And so let's set that problem up. This is not hard to do. In a confining, in an ADS context where you're looking at the dual to a theory which is in the UV, it's conformal, or approximately so, and in the infrared, it's confining. QCD-like, you can try to answer a question like this. And in particular, as I think pretty much people are getting used to by now, anytime you have something like this, you have an ADS throat, which would be infinite. Here's the boundary at r equals infinity. Here's the horizon at r equals 0. Confinement is basically just sets in by cutting off this space somehow. And what you have is a region where things are approximately ADS out here and a small region down here where things might be, say, approximately flat. Or it's just some nice smooth region, or maybe there's a throat there, but a throat appropriate to some other type of brain. In any case, there's some effective cutoff here at R min. And you have confinement, and you have a discrete spectrum, not necessarily a mass gap, but a discrete spectrum. Depends on whether you have chiral symmetry breaking or not. And of what type. The discrete spectrum is the masses, the splitting between masses is what I'll call lambda. That's just a definition. In terms of that, the confinement scale, the flux tube tension, is not lambda squared. It's equal to lambda squared over the square root, times the square root of lambda, little lambda. So it's much bigger. And what that means is the picture that I've been drawing here, which was originally for string theory and then shifted over for QCD, is also not quite the same for these theories either. It looks like this. What this is telling you is that if you look at the spin two glue balls, they're going to appear like this. They'll be close together. Actually, it turns out the spacing between them grows, but that's not an important effect. What's important is that the first spin 4 particle is way up here because the slope, the effective alpha prime, well, it has something to do with this flux tube tension. The statement that the flux tube tension is very large is that if you want to take a spin 2 particle and spin it up so you get a spin 4 particle, that takes a lot of energy, much more than a radial excitation, which could move you from the leading trajectory to a daughter trajectory. Okay, so we can read off from this what alpha naught of the leading trajectory is going to be. It's going to be approximately 2 minus something small. 2 minus something. Okay. So we should expect. And how do we set up this problem? Well, we want to have deep and elastic scattering off of quarkonium in this setup, and that's easy enough. We basically, with respect to the radial coordinate, let me plot r over r min, which is 1 at the confinement scale, infinity up here. And your photon is going to correspond to some mode, which tails off at a scale which is of order q over lambda, q squared being the momentum, q squared being the off-shellness of the photon. You're going to have a quarkonium state here, which ends at around m over lambda. And if you wonder why, you can ask Andreas or folks at Perimeter or anyone else, but I can tell you later. And now you want to ask, what happens to the quarkonium state when you boost it? Well, now you are asking the question of string theory in position space. So you would expect diffusion, but the question is, in what variable precisely? And the point is that in this problem, which is forward scattering, it's the easiest case. In forward scattering, as was appropriate for deep and elastic scattering, you're taking the imaginary part of a forward amplitude. It's really simple because basically everything is just a one-dimensional problem. There's nothing going on in the transverse dimensions of Minkowski space. The dimensions in the five-dimensional compact space are not important either. This is basically just an issue of how does this thing change in the radial direction. And the radial direction has a metric, which is dr over r. So it's useful to define u to be log r over r min, and then ds squared is just flat with respect to du. And so when you calculate what's going to happen, knowing that everything is completely trivial in the transverse dimensions of Minkowski space and in the five compact dimensions, what you expect is that diffusion is going to occur in the usual way that it does in flat space string theory just with respect to the coordinate u. And u is log r, and here we have log k perp. Okay, so the answer in string theory is going to be you're going to get a kernel, you're going to get some sort of kernel, which looks like e to the minus u prime squared over something, and there's going to be an s to the something out front. Now you just have to do a calculation. And I would love to show you that calculation, but that would take half an hour. So what I will do instead is just give you the answer for now. And it is 2 minus 2 over square root of lambda. And there is a square root of lambda up here. And I think a 2 log s. Okay, and that's the kernel in this regime. Now, you're really supposed to compare these things. These things could be, these two kernels could be applied to the same calculation. And in weak coupling, you have this answer, where you have to integrate this against two functions of k perp corresponding to the photon and the Kluarkonium state. Here, you're supposed to take this and integrate it against two functions of u and u prime, u for the photon, u prime for the Kluarkonium state. But you can ask it from the point of view of the Kluarkonium state, as we did when we wrote things. Sorry, you can ask it from the point of view of the photon, as we did when we wrote things this way. So you apply the kernel to the Kluarkonium state to see how it changes. And what it's going to do is it's going to gradually expand in the radial direction. And until the expansion reaches the confinement region, this is all within the conformally invariant region. You can do this safely, and there's no model dependence to it. It's a completely under control calculation in this sense. And you will get a growth, which goes like s. Oh, I forgot. There's the square root of log s, which comes from the fact that it's a diffusion kernel. And I'd love to tell you why it's a diffusion kernel. I don't think I'm going to have time. But let me just note a couple of things. Let's compare the weak and strong coupling results. First of all, they have exactly the same form with the appropriate translation that u is the same as log k perp. Second of all, they don't have the same coefficients, but that's not particularly surprising. You would expect those coefficients to change as a function of the Itauf coupling. And indeed, we've got this j naught is 1 plus 4 log 2 over pi lambda at small lambda. And at large lambda, it's 2 minus 2 over square root of lambda. But OK. That's just a fact. I'd love to derive this from string theory someday by actually solving string theory on ADS 5 cross S 5, but of course that's a little ways off. Then there's the diffusion constant, and the diffusion constant was order lambda in this case. And in this case, it's sort of 1 over square root of lambda. It's actually, let me leave it at that. And then there was this A4, the leading correction to the quadratic formula, and that's order lambda here. And it's order 1 over lambda here. It's much, much smaller, actually, than the quadratic piece. So in QCD, where lambda is small, the quadratic approximation is pretty good. At larger Itauf coupling, it's great. And at no place, as far as we can tell, is it bad. So this is a situation where you can really imagine smoothly continuing. The functional structure remains the same, only the coefficients gradually change. OK, I am pretty much out of time. Let me just ask quickly if there is a question about this. But what is really interesting, of course, is, I mean, it's neat to see the result, but best of all, it wouldn't be that exciting. What's really great is some of the other things to do with it. And so I'll spend 2 minutes concluding just by saying what those are. So first of all, what's especially nice here is that you not only you get this result, but you understand why you got it. This result essentially follows from conformal invariance and certain analytic constraints. You can, if you go back, you can make an argument that this function j of nu, which appeared here, and essentially is appearing here as well, had to be a polynomial, had to be something that had a good expansion in nu squared. And once you know that, it's going to have a good quadratic approximation at some regime, and so therefore you're going to get something which looks like diffusion. You're basically guaranteed this from conformal invariance. Now, when you start the QCD problem, if you don't use that fact, you work for pages and pages and pages and pages and pages, and then eventually you get to this answer. But the string theory just knows the answer. It just writes this down. It says, look, it's Regi physics. I know this is the right metric. This is the answer. Why does it do that? It's because it encodes two things. It encodes the conformal invariance in the geometry, and it encodes the right analytic structure in the Regi amplitude. And so you just get it. Yeah?
The integral structure you see in the Bolzano calculation, can you relate that to the structure we know that shows in string theory?
I don't know how to do that, no. Obviously, that's a very important question. If you want to go to small lambda, you want to understand some of that. But one should keep in mind also that even in that context, as you increase, so the simplest thing is to have two gluons coming in. But really, the full integrable structure you should eventually deal with would have any number of gluons coming in. So it becomes very rapidly difficult to do much better on the QCD side. What's, I think, really important is that you should have been able to say, without doing a calculation, that the form of the answer would be this to any order by conformal invariance. That's not obvious from BFKL, but it's obvious from the string theory because of the structure. You just see the conformal field theory has imposed this upon you. And post facto, you can make that argument, but you might not have thought to. So one of the things this is a case where the QCD answer is known, but you take a slightly harder problem where the QCD answer isn't known, and the string theory will be able to provide for you, in some cases, all the constraints of conformal invariance on the answer before you start. And boy, I would bet the BFKL would have had an easier time. Indeed, people will have an easier time doing calculations where they just sort of say, look, all I really need to know is this coefficient and that coefficient, and I'll spend all of my time just trying to calculate those two. Integral structures are great, but they're overkill in many cases. Okay, and the other thing I will say, although I didn't have time to really do anything with it, is that the string theory is perfectly happy going to negative t and positive t. Now, in QCD, BFKL can also do calculations at negative t. It took 8 years to figure out how to do that, again, because they were doing overkill to some degree. To get the quadratic answer, well, it's messier. I won't try to write it down or say much about it. But again, if you want to get that kind of answer from string theory, it's easy to do. You just you got this answer by solving some differential equation. You just modify the differential equation in some simple way that includes t. It's technically no harder. Just you don't get a closed form anymore, but you get it in terms of an integral. But you get an answer right away from the same differential equation with a small modification. Basically, it turns into the same differential equations you'd have in a quantum mechanics problem. And not surprisingly, because it's the same differential equations you have in a quantum mechanics problem, when you go to positive t, you'll start getting bound states in that quantum mechanics problem, and they're exactly these bound states. So you see the whole Regi structure, I shouldn't have said those. You get these. So you can see the whole structure as a function of t just by looking at differential equations in the string theory. And so that's very pretty. It gives you an opportunity to answer this question, how do the Regi trajectories behave as you go to negative t, just in a completely controlled way. Not exactly. Certainly not the way people said. And it's another whole talk. But the answer is that in the conformal case, no, they don't flatten out. They disappear into a cut, which sits here the whole time. And in the non-conformal case, it's a little more complicated. The cut breaks up into a bunch of poles, and then you have the trajectories do flatten out, but not the way people said they would. Okay. So you can resolve these questions, but it's too long to get into it. Once this stuff is well known, then it'll be easier to give that talk. Okay, so I think I'll stop there with the comment that this is, I think, a very good sign. We're really able to address questions which are important in QCD that you can't address within QCD. And although this isn't QCD itself, it answers it answers an issue in a way that only really the ADS context is of the things that we know is well developed to do. And one, I think, can hope that there'll be quite a few more of these to come. Thank you.
More questions for that? Last one. So to calculate this string formula, what do you actually do?
Okay, so the zeroth order statement was, look, you just say it's Regi physics. Okay? It's clearly going to be Regi physics, and so it can't be anything else. The second order thing you do is you say, look, I know the form of the amplitude. It's s to the alpha of t. And t is as measured by a local observer. And so that's not t of the field theory. It differs from t of the field theory, and I need to calculate what it is. And that's done in the deep and elastic scattering paper that Joel Polchinski and I wrote a couple of years ago. And so you can look there for some structure. But that gives you a differential operator whose solution is this. Okay, so you do it explicitly at that level. But there you're sort of using alpha, the fact that you knew the amplitude one is S of alpha of t. You can do one step better and really formulate this in terms of operators and so forth, and that will appear in the new paper. But it doesn't really add, I mean, it just it's technical grounding to something which is surely right from the beginning.
Would that matter again?